Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Seattle, Washington, and we have a very special guest on our show with us today, Professor Philip Johnson, who anyone who is familiar with the intelligent design movement, he needs no introduction. Professor Johnson is a professor of law, emeritus at Bolt Hall School of Law. He got his undergraduate degree at Harvard and his law degree from the University of Chicago, was a Supreme Court clerk, and is very well known in the intelligent design movement as really being one of the inspirations behind the movement for his works and his books on Darwinian evolution, showing that Darwinian evolution is not a theory that is beyond scientific critique, but is quite open to scientific critique. So, Professor Johnson, it's a real honor to have you on our show with us today.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you, Casey.
Well, we have you on the phone from California right now, and we wanted to speak with you, Professor Johnson, because you were recently interviewed, or within the last few months were interviewed by PBS and Nova for their upcoming PBS Nova Judgment Day Intelligent Design documentary on the Kitzmiller versus Dover trial. And it turns out that you, I believe, are one of the few ID proponents that ended up being interviewed for the documentary. And I'd like to talk to you about both the documentary and some of the publicity that PBS has been doing for the documentary, and also get your thoughts a little bit about the Kitzmiller versus Dover trial. So maybe we could start with that. I'd be curious for our listeners to be able to hear, what is your opinion of the Kitzmiller ruling overall?
Well, the judge decided to strike out for fame, and he got it. He became a hero to the scientific materialist world and the official scientific organs, and to publications like Time magazine that named him as one of the most significant intellectuals in the world. But it's just a rant, really, the opinion by a judge who didn't want to stick to just making a ruling in the case, but wanted to make himself a big player in the national scene and arguing about evolution and its resulting controversies.
Now, obviously, one of the biggest criticisms of the Kitzmiller ruling is that it goes too far in trying to do things like defining science or even deciding some very, you might call them, minutiae of the debate over intelligent design, like whether or not the type 3 secretory system could have been an intermediate to evolve the bacterial flagellum and these sorts of things.
Yes, he went way beyond his proper role as a trial court judge issuing a ruling in a case, and decided to write a book about the general subject of evolution and so on. Of course, it's a ghostwritten book because much of what he wrote was taken verbatim from the American Civil Liberties Union brief.
Is that something that you would call typical for judges to borrow so heavily in key sections from one of the parties' briefs?
It's typical enough for probably for judges to borrow a little from a brief if they agree with it. It's the extent of the borrowing and the degree to which it was beyond the judicial function to go so far into the details of the dispute. And one thing is that you mentioned specifically, Casey, that's amusing, is it's that defining of science. Now, scientists and philosophers of science have never been able to come up with a satisfactory definition of science. The Supreme Court has never been able to come up with a satisfactory division of religion. But this judge thinks, he seems to think he knows all about these subjects and could just off the top of his head issue rulings settling all these very difficult issues.
So if you were the judge presiding over the Kitzmiller case, how would you have decided it?
Well, I probably would have said as little as possible. In fact, once the judge had said it was religiously motivated, he didn't need to say anything more. He did say that. Now, whether motivation is really crucial or not is a question that could be debated, but the judge was applying a doctrine from the Supreme Court that makes religious motivation decisive, and he found that there was a religious motivation. He had material in the record to justify that finding.
Yes.
There was no need to go further, and I think it's just a question of ambition and desire for the spotlight.
So you would say that Judge Jones was looking to influence more people's opinions than merely settling the case that was before him.
He wasn't just deciding the case before it. He was entering into this debate. I don't know whether his primary desire was to influence people's opinion or to make a name for himself.
Now, let's switch over to the PBS Nova project, because obviously this Judgment Day intelligent design documentary is entirely about the Kitzmiller versus Dover case. And I'd like to find out a little about the interview that you actually went through. But first off, how did you get involved with the PBS Nova project?
Well, I wonder whether it was a good idea. It might have been wiser on my part to have stayed away from it. I wasn't told that it was a program about the Kitzmiller versus Dover case. The producer who phoned me said that they were going to ask something about that, but I thought that the program was mainly about the nature of the intelligent design movement, and I thought that was something that I could contribute something to, and I was glad to see that subject on the NOVA program. So it's something of a shock to me to find out that the sole focus of the program is the Kitzmiller case.
Very interesting.
If they presented it to me that way, I don't think I would have participated.
Is that right? Now, why would you not participate if it was about the Kitzmiller case?
Well, I had nothing to do with the Kitzmiller case, and don't feel that that was something I was really interested in participating in. And I also feel that that's a subject on which I would expect nothing but propaganda.
So
I would be suspicious of. Now, I don't mind. I'm quite sure that the program will be the party line of the scientific establishment about this issue, but there's nothing I can do about that if that's what they're going to do. I'm just hoping that there isn't some unfair editing of my own part.
Well, this is a good lead into my next question, actually. Did you feel that when they conducted the interview that it was fair? Did you get any
hints? The people who conducted the interview, the camera people and the producer who asked questions, were fine. I had a very good discussion with them. But that's just the thing that is worrisome. One of the things that happens with these television setups is that they send out a perfectly reasonable interviewer and film crew, and then they hope to get the subject speaking unguardedly, and then the real damage is done back in the editing room when they look to pick out something that will serve their purpose and discredit the subject. So that's what I'm worried about.
Very
is the what goes on in the editing room. As if it was just a matter of the filming crew that came out to talk to me, I would feel fine about it.
And I think that the general understanding is that you were perhaps the only leading ID proponent that was interviewed for this documentary. So what does that do for your blood pressure when you think about what might happen with this documentary?
So I say I'm not particularly worried about the documentary itself. If they're going to put on a documentary that takes the party line, then that's what they're going to do, and I can't do anything to stop that, nor would I. They can put out the point of view that they want to, and I'm just a little worried that I got involved in talking with them, and I don't know what's going to happen with the editing at WGBH in Boston. I have been lucky in the past. I've almost had a charmed life of interviews that things could have turned out badly, and I could have been misquoted or edited in an unfair way, but this has not been my experience, so I'm hoping it won't be my experience this time. If they just put me on saying what I said, then no matter what the overall slant of the program is, I can't complain.
So as far as the slant goes, are you anticipating that this will be biased in a certain direction? Sounds like you are.
I think that the NOVA people and the WGBH people would catch a lot of criticism and be given a lot of grief by their friends in the scientific establishment if they did not come out with a slanted documentary that was slanted towards the official scientific establishment party line.
Now, there's one other item I'd like to ask you about, Professor Johnson, because we can get a little bit of a sneak preview as to what this documentary is going to be about, because they have actually been sending out briefing packets to teachers, my understanding, teachers all around the country in public schools regarding how to deal with teaching evolution in schools. And it's a very one-sided briefing packet. I've read through it, and it very much promotes the view that intelligent design is a religious view, that it's not science, and so forth. And of course, as you said, you know, this is the party line, and this is not too unexpected for them to be taking the party line. What was concerning was when they recommended in the teacher's guide that teachers basically inject religion into the science classroom by discussing religious denominations that accept evolution. And I'd like to just read a brief excerpt from the briefing packet to you, Professor Johnson, and get your reaction to it for our listeners. The question asks, can you accept evolution and still believe in religion? And the answer goes on to say, in part, yes, the common view that evolution is inherently anti-religious is simply false. And then later on, it goes on to give various examples of religious denominations that accept evolution. And of course, there's no mention of any religious views that might be skeptical of evolution in this briefing packet. So I guess my question for you is, of course, these people are entitled to whatever view they want as far as whether religion conflicts with evolution. And of course, many religious people find no conflict with evolution. But when they are recommending that public school teachers teach this sort of a view in the science classroom, for instance, does that raise any legal troubles in your mind?
Well, it raises legal trouble if you want to see them. The problem is that some of our federal judges, like Judge Jones in this program, have decided to take on a role of protecting the science establishment from criticism of their most sacred doctrine. And so they don't want to see any legal problems, and they won't. One thing that one sees in this kind of an approach is that when you teach evolution in the schools, you are bringing religious issues into the classroom, because when you're talking about how all the forms of life came into existence or got created, that is a religious issue. And if you say it was by unintelligent material forces only, and God had nothing to do with it, which is the party line in the evolutionary science world, that is their consistent position, the fact that they're putting out a pamphlet with a statement like that just illustrates that when you're teaching evolution in the public schools and you're teaching Darwinian evolution and the official line of the evolutionary science community, you're teaching religious questions. You're getting into those, and then you have to sort out good religion from bad religion, which is what they're doing. They want to talk about the denomination that accept the evolutionary story that they're saying. That's good religion. That's the clear implication of what they're saying. So
sure.
There could involve a legal issue, I would think, yes, if you want to see it. If you try to get that in front of Judge Jones and get him to see the legal issue, he's not going to see it because he doesn't want to see it.
And of course, the briefing packet is actually following Judge Jones's approach quite closely. Judge Jones ruled that it was,
yes,
quote, utterly false, unquote, to say that religion conflicts with evolution and so forth. So,
legal question or not, that's very misleading language. That's why I object to it mainly, is it's misleading. What would be more accurate to say is that there is a dispute about whether the theory of evolution implies the non-existence of God as a creator. It's a matter that's in dispute, not something that is obviously settled the way that Judge Jones and the scientific establishment have decided that it ought to be settled. And in fact, one of the phenomena that's in the news today is that there is a big surge, just as we have a surge of troops in Iraq, there is a surge of scientific atheism in the scientific community. It is headed by Richard Dawkins, the Oxford professor, who is the world's most prominent promoter of Darwinism and also the world's most prominent promoter of atheism. Now,
yes,
if you ask Dawkins whether the Darwinian theory implies atheism, he's not going to answer no. He's not going to answer like Judge Jones and the pamphlet you're quoting answered. So it's no coincidence that the world's most prominent Darwinist is also the world's most prominent promoter of atheism. Now, it's true that there are other people who take a different implication from Darwinism. People like Francis Collins, the head of the U.S. government's Human Genome Project. Collins is an outspoken evangelical Christian who says there's no conflict between Darwinian evolution and his religion. But Collins is much publicized for this view. But when you read a news story about Collins or a review of his book, it'll generally point out how remarkable a thing it is that Collins doesn't see a conflict between his the scientific theory he's endorsing and his religious position. He's an exception. He's a remarkable person. So it's in dispute. It isn't clear. It isn't that everybody agrees that Darwinism does lead to atheism, or that it doesn't. There's a dispute about that matter. That makes it an important religious question. An accurate statement would be telling the students that the connection between Darwinism and atheism is in dispute, not that it's been settled that there's no connection. So this is very typical that information is put out from the Darwinian establishment and its allies that is very seriously misleading. And then this is presented as absolute truth to the students in the schools with that official endorsement. So the students are being taught very misleading information, even outright lies. What's going on here is a process of soothing. The scientific establishment has decided that the way to get a reluctant American public to put aside their doubts and believe what they're being told in the mass media and the textbooks and the museums about evolution is absolutely true is to reassure them. It doesn't threaten your religion. Then after they have been talked into accepting the theory, then the types like Richard Dawkins will come out and say, well, actually, now that you've accepted it, we have to tell you that it does destroy your religion. That's the 1-2 punch. First you soothe them into accepting something, and then you give them hit them with the other shoe. These kinds of statements and materials that come out cannot be trusted. They are not honest. They attempt to give a very one-sided and hence a misleading description of the situation. Many parents understand this, and this is why they're so upset with what the schools are doing. These things get into the media. Reporters will ask the official scientific organizations for what they should print about it. And they'll say, oh, these people are religious fanatics who are completely unreasonable because they're seeing something we don't want them to see.
And all of this raises a question that I would be very interested in your answer in, Professor Johnson, because, I mean, you follow this debate for many years. You're aware that for decades, the scientific community has been issuing statements to the effect of science and religion do not conflict. They may even say they're totally separate spheres. They can't even conflict in principle. And yet, public skepticism of evolution remains very high. What does this say to you? Is there more? I mean, why are these attempts to, as you put it, soothe religious people regarding evolution? It really seems like they're failing. At least the public that is largely religious is still very skeptical.
Yes, they still are very skeptical, and they don't believe the reassurances. They know that's not what's going on. The fact is the public is not as stupid as the experts wish them to be.
And do you think also that there are scientific doubts that the public has that are not being seen?
Yes, there are. There are scientific doubts that the public knows that the theory of evolution can be demonstrated or tested by experiment only at a relatively trivial level. When you ask the evolutionary scientists to come up with an example of how their theory has been demonstrated, they'll always come back to the same examples of things like insect populations becoming resistant to insecticides. They don't have any examples of insects changing into something fundamentally different, as it would have to be able to do if the theory is true in a general way. So the situation that the public realizes is that evolution can be demonstrated or tested scientifically only at the trivial level of what's often called microevolution. Microevolution isn't really evolution at all. A better term for it would be adaptive variation. You do see some minor changes going on in populations or species. You do not see one kind of a plant or animal evolving into something fundamentally different. The public knows this. They know something is being sold to them. It's kind of like the way used cars are sometimes sold.
Well, Professor Philip Johnson, we're running out of time here, and it has been wonderful to have you on our show. This has been very enlightening. Thank you so much for sharing your insights into this issue with us today. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.